Hello and welcome, listeners, to Ion EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hi, Jen. I'm so excited to be here with you today. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I just love speaking with you. I always come away with learning a few things more than I did before. Would you like to take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Jennifer May. Most people call me by my first and last name for some reason, Jen May. Just rolls off the tongue easier, I guess. I'm the Accessibility Experiential Learning Coordinator for the Career and Experiential Learning Department. Basically, what that means is I support the department with accessibility initiatives that will support students with disabilities in transitioning into their career or co-op placement or workplace environment. And then in addition to that, I teach Co-op 1000, which is a career management course, which prepares students with job search skills and work search skills to better prepare them to go out there and look for work. So that's what I do. I do often like to start out with my social positioning so that people know the lens from which I am speaking. So I am a biracial person of color, identify. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am a first generation Chinese Canadian person. My mom immigrated, her parents immigrated from England. My dad immigrated here from Borneo. He's Chinese born in Borneo. I also have, I live with invisible disabilities. In particular, ADHD is the one that wreaks the most havoc on my life. I have a love-hate relationship with it because it can be a lot of fun because I'm pretty spontaneous, pretty bubbly. But on the other hand, I can definitely lose my train of thought and have difficulty finding words. And then along with that, usually comes a little bit of anxiety. So those are the invisible disabilities that I live with. I also have quite a bit of privilege. I am educated. I have meaningful employment. I have access to basic needs. I'm cisgendered. And so that is sort of the position in which I come at my work from and sort of even really live my life day to day.
I'm glad that you brought up some of the more invisible parts of life because here on this podcast, we really strive to be inclusive and aware of the fact that not every day is the best day to talk about racism, or not every day is the day where you feel the most comfortable encountering racism. And just we really strive to take a trauma-informed approach to it and just be really open. And so I really appreciate that you brought that up. You and I think, connect on an interesting level because I am also a first generation Canadian. I think that's when, okay, you'll have to clarify this for me. I always get confused. That's when your parents aren't born here.
First generation born in Canada.
Oh, wait, what if you're not born then?
What if you're not born in Canada? If you
immigrated as a baby.
Oh, if you immigrated as a baby, then you're an immigrant.
Ah, well, never mind. I just changed my identity right here.
Why for everybody to listen to. Well, I mean, at least that's how I understand it, but really, you know what, self-determination, girl.
It's so confusing, isn't it, just to like trying to figure out how you fit into the world.
I know it's a mystery,
and I find that in particular it's interesting when you are trying to just function in the world and you're constantly like a person of color. So I feel like there's this added layer of hesitancy going out in the world, which I don't think many people realize.
Yeah, I think that for me, part of my armor, so to speak, when I go out into the world is to appear like the dominant culture. So I want to dress appropriately. I want to be put together, these sorts of things, because I worry that if I go out looking disheveled, that I will be treated differently because of how I look. So as long as I can pass as part of the culture, I'm more likely to get better interactions with people. So it is a very precarious situation, and it is extra work to have to think about that when you go out into the world.
Yeah, that's something that I've always experienced. I can't just walk out the door in sweatpants because I think the world already has a really low expectation or opinion of me and people that look like me. And so I don't want to impact everybody else that comes after me. And I think it kind of goes beyond just clothing and into the way you talk. Like if you're having a bad day, I think I don't have the license to just express the fact that I'm having a bad day. Mm-hmm. I have to, you know, mask that to prevent it from being bad for people that come after me. Mm-hmm. I don't fall into a generalization. So, oh yeah, all immigrants are just angry, or, you know, those like stereotypes mm-hmm. and generalizations that people kind of pin on you, especially when you're the first person of color they've ever met or interacted with. It's just an incredibly huge burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think too, that stereotype of, as you said, an angry immigrant or an angry person of color, or, you know, why can't you just get over it? Like, you just, you know, be a part of the culture and whatever that is, and, you know, blend in. This is what it means to be Canadian. But if we really shine a light on that, we know that what it means to be Canadian, it means different things to different people. And people that live here come from different places and have different lenses. And so in my opinion, what it means to be Canadian is it means to be diverse. And it means that we accept other points of view and perspectives in an inclusive way. And I've heard this term before, suspending judgment. I think that, yeah, it's difficult when you go out into the world and you feel like you're the person that's going to set the bar for what everyone's going to think. And in my case, I'm a bit of a chameleon because I like to call it ethnically ambiguous. Depends on where I am. People will speak to me in Spanish. They might think I'm Indigenous. Italian, there's been a lot of different questions about my ethnicity as well. So that's another layer of questions to answer and things to explain when I go out into the world.
Right. And then I feel because, well, I just look like me, but I think there's misconceptions that people have living, especially in North America, about what people around the world are supposed to look like. And so I get that, oh, are you from Saudi Arabia? Or that one I get the most. Or where are you from? Or instead of people asking, they'll make an assumption on where I'm from or where I'm supposed to be. And then you suddenly become a representative of another culture as well without having asked for it. And it's like, well, I didn't do anything. I didn't try to represent you, but somehow I am now the spokesperson for all the melanated people in the world. POC Council of Representatives.
The order of the POC. I agree with that. And, you know, part of it comes down to this responsibility or this sort of almost burden that we take on because we care so much and we find ourselves in places that are not comfortable and that sometimes are very exhausting to have the candle burning at both ends. But yet, for some reason, we stay and endure, you know? And so, yeah, absolutely. We end up in this position where you know that that's what's going to happen, but the fight is still enough to keep you in those spaces sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes.
You said the word spaces and it makes me think about the fact sometimes as a woman of color, you experience things, but you're not quite sure if there's a word for it or if there is like any literature to back it up, because, you know, anything that's in literature is automatically more credible. Do you understand that experience? Because I just recently, I felt like most places in the world, or in Canada at least, weren't welcoming of me. And I felt like they weren't built for me. So I've always wanted to be a golf person. Not really. Well, my mom wants to be a golf person and I just want to, you know, hang out with her. So I wanted to, you know, kind of just see what it's like to play golf. But golf is the most terrifying place for me. And it's like, I don't think I can go into a golf place. Or when I started playing tennis, that I'm not sure if I can go into a tennis club and feel comfortable. And I didn't. I really didn't feel comfortable in that space. And so it makes you wonder if these spaces are built for you. And I just recently was reading something, and I can't remember the title of it. I should have noted it down. But it spoke about how most spaces on earth in Canada are white spaces. And that's when I figured out that, oh, there's a terminology. So when I looked up white spaces, it was like, oh, wow. So I'm not the only one who encountered this.
I think that there are a lot of white spaces. I have an analogy to kind of explain those kinds of systems of oppression. And what it is imagine a group of friends built a maze and they lived in the maze and they were comfortable in the maze and they were there so long that they felt that it wasn't even a maze at all. But people who were new to the maze were different from the people that built the maze. They found it difficult or almost impossible to navigate it. And so there were barriers at every stop. So we think about it like the people that created the system created barriers for people who are different. Sometimes that gives people a little bit of a visual of what that feels like. And when you're in a position like we are, where we happen to be people who are not only gatekeepers within the maze because we're working within the system, but we're also trying to support people through the maze. So it's very, it's a very precarious two-sided coin to be in. That sometimes that's really helped, I think, some people kind of think about what kinds of spaces they take for granted and how those spaces might actually create barriers for other people, people who are different than the status quo.
I really love that maze analogy. I find that myself. I'm often just questioning how the system works. Something as simple as, I think, the summer's wildfire season. That was incredibly stressful because I didn't understand how evacuations worked. I didn't know what a tactical evacuation was and how all of these systems worked. The way that somebody who has been familiar with it for a long time would. And that's a really simple example. And there's obviously many more that are much deeper than that. But I really understand that. And going back to that terminology idea, I recently discovered that all this exhaustion that we feel from having to carry, you know, the gatekeeper position, in addition to somebody who's just trying to uplift your community at all times, but then also just trying to exist as a person in the world. So all that emotional burden has a word for it. It's emotional tax. And I had no clue.
Yeah. I mean, I call that having one foot in power and the other in solidarity. It's hard to have one foot on one side and one foot on the other all the time. And with the way things, just to kind of tie it into what's going on in the world today, it's additionally exhausting because people who are marginalized are at greater risk of not having the resources that they need to stay safe and healthy. And so it feels icky to, you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like that is overlooked amongst the sort of conflict that goes on in, you know, amongst people who have privilege. I feel like the people who are marginalized sometimes get lost, fall between the cracks, and you feel like you don't have a voice. And so that's sort of how I feel right now. Like, I feel like that sort of pressure to kind of keep upbeat and feel like, yeah, like gung-ho and positive and like change maker. I feel like I want to just be like, nah.
I get that all the time. Oh, I'm so glad that you said it first, to be completely honest, because it sounds kind of strange coming from me because, you know, I'm hosting this podcast, but it's honestly such a thing. I sometimes just, I think it was just yesterday that I was like, so does racism even matter? Can I just throw this out the window? Uh-huh. And then I left my house and I was like, oh yeah, never mind. It matters. Nobody let me forget that for a second. But it's just like, sometimes you just want to give up and you don't want to have to deal with it all the time.
And you wonder, like, what else would I be doing though?
Yeah, like fighting racism and making change has been my identity, I think, my entire life. And it's like, well, if this isn't my identity, then what is it? Like, what am I?
Yeah. And I think it really comes down to that. I remember saying to my partner, I said, you know what? Sometimes I wish I was just isolated on a farm and I just didn't know what was going on in the world. And I was blissfully ignorant. And, you know, I just never had to deal with any of these things. And you know what he said to me? He's like, Jen, you would have left the farm anyway. So it kind of just is who you are, right? I think so.
You know what the sad part for me is, that I, you know, am a Canadian citizen. And when I go overseas, that's kind of what I tell people. But at some point, it kind of makes you feel like you're not Canadian enough for the Canadian society. Mm-hmm. And you're not, like, whatever your other ethnicity or culture is, enough for the other culture. And it makes you fall into that limbo where you feel like there is no backup plan. There's no place to back out. So I was just thinking about, hey, sometimes I just imagine myself, hey, what if I just immersed myself in a world that looked like me, like just moved away from here completely. And then it makes me think again, oh, wait, never mind. I can't do that because I don't fit in there in total at all either. What my point is that I also get that. I just want to escape to the hermit farm and just never come out and just be me without my skin color, without that being a variable. You know,
the burden of being bicultural. I've been to Asia a couple of times and I noticed that there were a number of people that looked like me. They're probably mixed. And I suddenly felt like people weren't looking at me. Like, it was a really weird feeling. And I found myself looking at white people on the train. because I'm like, oh, there's a white person, like, what? Like, no, that's, and so when I'm here, because it's dominantly white, I identify as Chinese because I feel like I need to explain why I look different. Also culturally, I was brought up more with that worldview. So, but here it deflects more if I say this is what I am, rather than having to explain that my mom is white and my dad is Chinese and this is what happened. So I, yeah, I just say that. And I used to say I used to say I'm half Chinese. And I remember running into a fellow of color out one night, and he said to me, so I assume the other half is white. And I thought to myself, this is what I've been saying my whole life, that I'm half Chinese, because I'm trying to explain to people why I don't look white. So that's why I say biracial now, so I can give creds to both my ethnicities. But I myself racialized myself by saying that I was half Chinese.
You know, I think that that's a really interesting point that you bring up, because it just reminds me of how if it can sometimes feel like a betrayal of yourself or people around you, because if I say that I'm Canadian, I'm ignoring a whole other aspect of me, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that Canadian doesn't quite define your ethnicity, mm-hmm. because of course, the many, many, many different First Nations groups that lived here for so long. And so it doesn't make sense to me to express that as an identity, but it also doesn't just make sense to me to just express being born in Pakistan as an identity, because if I go back and I interact with people, I'm still the odd one out there. Yeah. And it can make you feel a little like homeless in the most privileged way possible. Not to discount people like who are actually experiencing homelessness, but it can make you feel like a privileged person who has no place to go to. Yeah. There's a saying, I think, okay, now I'm gonna have to think on which language this is. Sorry, sometimes these analogies that I have in my head, because we speak so many languages at home, they can get lost in the languages, but I'm guessing this one is Punjabi. So it's like the laundry person, the person does laundry. So people in South Asia have laundry shops, laundromats, yeah, they have them here too. But it's like the actual person owns it and does the laundry, so you don't go and do the laundry. So it's a laundry man. Dog is not from, like, doesn't belong to the house or to the shop, because, you know, if he goes into shop, gets the clothes dirty, goes to home, it gets the clothes dirty too. So that did not make sense in English whatsoever.
But it does. It makes sense. It makes sense to me, actually, because I feel like we have all kinds of things like that in Chinese as well, like that are kind of like these analogies are almost like Chinese prophecies.
Proverbs?
Oh, I don't know. Why don't I know the word? Either way, we have lots of those kinds of things as well. So yeah, I understand what that means.
Okay, good.
No sense of home, no sense of belonging.
Yeah, that's that in a much better way of saying it, no sense of home. And I think there's an element of guilt to it as well, mm-hmm. which comes with the privilege of being able to ignore the news. And just recently with everything going on in the world, the last year, I've had white friends who are just like, oh, well, I don't listen to the news. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't listen to the news? Yeah, it doesn't affect me, so I don't listen to the news. Mm-hmm. And my mind just went, mm-hmm. Wait, you don't listen? Why don't you listen to the news?
Yeah, like, this isn't the only, like, country on the planet. Like, you don't, like, we're not in a little bubble planet on our own. It might feel like that, but it's not. So, like, there's a lot more going on in the world that I think people don't. Like anything, though, if it doesn't affect you, it's hard to pay attention to it. We have a lot of, I don't know if you know this, but equity, diversity, and inclusion is trendy. You know, we have a lot of calls to action for this. It's a job for some people, because when you're on your own, live going about your day-to-day business in your life, and you don't have to worry about it, it doesn't affect you. So you don't really have to think about it on a daily basis and question what you're doing when you're in the grocery store, or what you're doing when you're going to the mall, or what you've asked someone at work. Like, you don't really have to think about it unless it's in your face and it's sort of almost like a job description of responsibility. But as long as it doesn't affect you, how do you get passionate about that? I'm not blanket statementing that and using that as a verb, because we have lots of allies too. But I often find that part of the reason is that people are really invested in their way of knowing and don't see really a reason to change it, because they're doing just fine.
Well, it's also incredibly difficult, I think, to have your identity and your way of knowing uprooted from you.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to, Have you ever heard of a former prime minister, like what they're doing after their prime minister, or a former president? No, not really.
Well, you know, yeah. Bill's been up to some stuff, I guess. Bill Clinton. I think he read a book. Yeah, they're almost like celebs now.
Yeah, they kind of like go like, well, Obama aside, they kind of they kind of fade into the background, though. You don't really, you don't go back to holding a public office again. Most people don't go from being prime minister to MP, at least I'm assuming. And so I think it's kind of the same thing, where nobody gives up a position of power to go into a lower position. And I think that's almost natural for people. The lion, like the head of the pride in the lion world. Sorry, I love the Lion King. So I think about them constantly. But the head of the pride doesn't go to just being, you know, a regular lion again. And I think that's incredibly uncomfortable. And it's okay to acknowledge the fact that people may not want to give up their privilege.
Oh, I think they don't. That's evident. But I guess one thing to think about is to kind of reframe that for people and saying that you can't have something taken away that you already have power over. So if you are to include somebody, the only thing that's going to happen is for you to add to it, not take away. If you're in a position of power and you are including other people, that means that you have a different sort of power, and that's still good. It's not giving up anything, because you are by default in power. So we are not able to take that from you. We can only add to it. It's just like when you have you know, people who are talking about a culture or an identity. So we don't want, you know, immigrants or Indigenous people to take away our culture, to change our culture. People need to come and do our thing, but without actually thinking that we can't take that away from you. You came here and you basically like threw it in our faces. And now we're just like, is there any way you can include us? Yeah, because that's anything it's going to add to, and it's going to enrich the power that you already have.
I'm incredibly happy that you turned that around, because I think you have days where you're more optimistic about racism and then days where you're not. And I think today might have been a day that I'm not, and I completely ignored that aspect. It reminded me of, I love stand-up comedy too, that I watched recently about someone, it was Trevor Noah, he's a comedian from South Africa, was talking about Brexit and was saying that, oh, all these immigrants are coming and taking away our culture. They're bringing their own food, their own culture, and speaking their own language. And he said, well, that sounds pretty British to me. Like, isn't that funny? So that makes me just think that that element of fear isn't necessary, because there's nothing wrong with more than one kind of person existing in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the individualistic nature of Western societies, is it's really about your own personal freedoms and your own rights over the collective. And I mean, that's my interpretation, because I come from a collectivist type worldview. And so that would be my assessment. I really think that the government or the powers that be of the systems are designed exactly we constructed them to do exactly what they're doing. And the way that people experience that depends on their privilege.
Right. And I think that it creates a barrier to making change, where you say that the system's broken, because the system's exactly how it's supposed to be. Yep. Broken is just your perception of it. It's completely the way it was built to be. It was built to be harder for people like you and I, who have last names that don't sound Western or European, have a harder time finding a job, or to be the trophy person in different friend groups in different areas. And so I kind of resent it when people say that the system's broken. I get a little sad.
I like to say that, you know, the rules weren't made to protect me. They were made to protect you from me. The idea of me, the difference of me, the language of me, all of the culture of me, it protects you from that. But when you feel like it's no longer protecting you from that, then it's upsetting, right? Like, it's upsetting when it impacts your day-to-day life. But other than that, it's protecting you, a dominant culture, from people like us talking about things like this, going around trying to like be champions for inclusivity, because inclusivity means change. It means changing. So in order to preserve that, we need to make rules that protect the dominant culture from people who are different.
You know, I think that's the difference in worldview that we, like, as collectivistic cultures, you and I have, mm-hmm. is that I don't see why people need protection from something different, you know? Going through history, there's always been times where people have, you know, brought things in. There's been a fusion of some sort and many different kind of things come through it. Cuisines, dances, and all different music. But superficial things aside, there's always things to learn from each other and different positive things. I always noticed people from individualistic cultures, when they go through something, it seems like they're going through it alone. But when I go through it, I bring like 30 people that go through everything with me.
Exactly. I do the same thing.
I'll tell all my family and friends. And it's like, it feels better because you're not the only one dealing with this. It's like 30 other people with you, or 20 or 100 sometimes. Let's be honest, our families are quite large. Mm-hmm. Trying to come up with solutions for us and with us. Mm-hmm. And it's relieving. Mm-hmm. It's okay mm-hmm. to, like, and I think that people would really benefit from those aspects. Like, imagine if everybody from an individualistic culture had the opportunity to experience that collaboration and collective problem solving.
Like, that would be great. I wonder though if it would be uncomfortable. I have to acknowledge that I was born here. I was raised in a Western culture. I understand it. And I have a lot of privilege because of that, because I can bridge, I can code switch, which means I can, you know what I mean? You can talk, you can speak in a collectivist way, or you can speak in an individualistic way, or different
shifting based on the context. Yeah.
Yeah. Based on the context. So I don't necessarily feel particularly comfortable coming from that worldview. I want to not worldview bash though. I think the point though of having these discussions is to look critically at our scenarios and situations and to shine a light on, you know, the experiences of other Canadians.
I think there is like things to be learned, like on both sides. Like there's nothing wrong with learning from each other.
That's right. Yeah,
okay. Knowledge is great. Speaking of knowledge, perfect segue. I was actually looking over your master's. Sorry, is it called a thesis?
Yeah.
And I was reading over it and okay, I'm going to give the floor to you. Would you like to talk on it? Because I find it incredibly fascinating.
Sure. So my research was on the mental health disclosure experiences of post-secondary students transitioning into career experiential learning environment. What I wanted to know is how people experienced that disclosure, what the level of fear was, whether they had a positive response, a negative response. I also looked at it from an intersectional perspective and thinking about how different cultures and even within our own culture, different groups of people experience and define mental health and what that would mean for disclosure for them and how they might disclose that. And, you know, really looking at, are we really serving the greater population because we approach our mental health in such a clinical and Western way? So I wanted to kind of look at that. But I also wanted to kind of, shine a light is the right word, but like kind of look at how in our pursuit to create equity and support students with disabilities in employment, and seeing as the student population has been underrepresented for like over 50 years, 25 years at minimum, and our mandate is to move forward, how are we going to do that if we don't know how students are feeling and what they're experiencing? And what we discovered then is that 70% of students experience a very high level of fear disclosing mental health and felt that they got a low positive response from both employers and faculty. So that is a concern. The other interesting piece that came out of that was that white students felt more confident disclosing, but felt that their response was lower than racialized or Indigenous students, where, you know, it was the opposite for racialized and Indigenous students. They weren't very confident about disclosing and then felt that they had a better experience than they were expecting. And it's quite evident that, like, it's very well illustrated in the research that there's this incongruency in experience. And so I think that is a really important thing to note, that when you have privilege, you're expecting to have a certain response. And when you don't get it, it feels awful. But when you're not expecting a good response and you get one that's a little bit better than you expected, it feels like a more positive response. And the reason why I would explain it that way is because we know that racialized people and Indigenous people they experience more complex barriers and more discrimination and more difficulties with that. With disclosure and transitioning into career, there's many barriers. So it would stand to reason that it's a matter of privilege that would make that sort of discrepancy happen. So that would be the sort of the explanation for that. But I thought that was really interesting to actually come out in the data. So really the idea of the research is to find practical ways to support students in this transition and to create safer spaces for disclosure and find out exactly what they're asking for. So, you know, coming at it from a very student-centered perspective and being able to tailor resources and services around students' concerns or around what their accommodation might be for mental health, you know, whether or not they feel safe to disclose, when they should disclose, if they should, what is the risk factor of disclosing. So yeah, I think the research is really rich and it provides opportunity for future research in the field because we haven't even explored specific groups of people. For example, like what is the experience of biracial people, like disclosing mental health and like explaining what that means, or, you know, LGBTQ+ students, what does that feel like to them? You know, we don't have any data on that at all. And that's why I have a sort of a basic description or basic findings as leads to other branches of research that could be done on the topic. This happens to be the first research of its kind, because we haven't been paying attention. It's really important for universities to know that we haven't been paying attention and that we need to do better.
But what really sparked in my head after speaking to you was the term that you used in your research, racialized students.
Racialized, yeah.
And that's the term that I'll go with. for racialized students or racialized people in general, our expectations are pretty low. And mm-hmm. and most of the time, I don't have much expectation at all because we're used to things not working the same way or not working as well. Or when systems provide the bare minimum, it feels like a huge win. Mm-hmm. And I never realized how that would look on paper, because on paper, I would think like if somebody just looked right at the data and didn't look at anything, just looked at the fact that, oh, they had better experiences around disclosure. Great. That means that they're feeling more supported. And it never crossed my mind that people wouldn't realize that our expectations are so low. Anything's great.
Yeah, anything is great. Anything is great. You feel like it's a win. You feel like you've moved a little bit, you know, an inch forward, a centimeter forward to get to meet whatever your personal goals are, your, you know, career goals, your educational goals. It's a different sort of experience. And if anybody gets a chance to kind of flip through it, there's lots of data and graphs and things like that. But it's pretty interesting to kind of look at it and just see like what people's experiences have been. And, you know, really, truly, like only 19% of students said they would ask for accommodations. That's not enough. They or feel comfortable doing that. We know that most students are not set up for success in their career placements because of the disclosure issue. And we also know that the big reason for that is because of stigma. And then imagine having other identities on top of that. And so part of the research, the precipice of my research, is really acknowledging intersectional identities and that we can't really pull people's identities apart and serve different parts of them, because when you're in those scenarios, you can only identify as one thing. And really, that's not possible, because every part of the person makes up the whole person. And so I, in the end, suggested some ways that we could, as an institution, be inclusive of people with intersectional identities. And one way is just to assume that everyone that walks in your office has one, and to apply the protocols. So the pronouns, the cultural sensitivity, there can be people who are white passing. So you can't really make an assumption about what their culture or worldview is like. So you should, or we should, as institutions, assume that we have people with intersectional identities in our offices or in our paths whenever we cross paths with someone. That's what inclusivity means, because instead of assuming that you are one thing in a dominant culture, you are assuming potentially that you could be all things, which means that's inclusive. And why wouldn't you want to do that? It's a really simple fix. It's not really a fix, but it's simple. It's a simple step that people can do. It's just assume that I come into your office, I could be LGBTQ+, I could be Indigenous, I could be any of those things, but I sound like I'm Western, but you know, there's a cultural sensitivity that needs to happen, and really just coming in to a scenario rather than referring people out. Right. So those are kind of some of my ideas on how that can happen, because we tend to try to refer people out to the EDI office. Oh, hey, that's the building we're going to send the people that are different from us over there. Those people know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. I don't need to know how to deal with it. They can deal with it because that's their expertise, right? So it's a concept.
Sorry, I as people speak, I start imagining things that they're saying happening in my head.
Yeah.
So I just had an image of like you and I just marching over
to the building.
We're going to the
EDI building.
Like you and I just marching over.
Building, yeah.
Somebody's just told us that. Nope, you go there.
You go over there. Yes. We don't know anything about equity.
But except we were marching like I watched something where people were marching really funny, and that's so you and I were like high kneeing our way over there. Anyway, sorry.
It's funny though. And I mean, I have to say though, how things should be or not is not how things are. No. So if we even had an EDI office, that would be a step in the right direction.
Right. Yeah. We have the intercultural department. Which,
right. Right.
Yeah. What I really like about this research in particular is the fact that it brings mental health into it. I mean, there's a lot of things that I love about it, but I love mental health because I think as a society, although we're not perfect, we've shifted our view on mental health a lot. And it kind of reminds me of how you said, like walking into any office and there being an opportunity, you know, somebody to respond to you and respond, like talk about mental health. And I think it's become a little bit more of a universal conversation than it used to be 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was quite young, but that's kind of what I remember. But it being a different conversation, not everybody being equipped to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of how racism and the after effects of it are essentially a mental health issue. Uh-huh. Because everything that we've talked about today on this podcast is how we live our life and our ability to thrive being impacted by this external stressor. Uh-huh. And right that in there is an impact on our mental health.
Exactly. There's going to be that intersection for most people who are experiencing racism. Like it's just a thing. So, you know, and it's unfortunate that in this particular system, we have to have a diagnosis to prove that the racism is bothering us. So it's hard to say, hey, you know what, I need an accommodation because I am experiencing a lot of anxiety about, let's say, coming back to campus because you have to deal with all the microaggressions and you need to have like a little bit of it. You get some, you know, exposure therapy because, you know, you've been removed from that. And you know what, but we have to be like, well, okay, we're going to need the diagnosis. What is the cause of your anxiety? Well, it's racism. Is that clinical? Well, right. It's systemic. It's like, it's really like a fine line. And that's why I'm such a proponent for universal design, especially right now, especially for our marginalized community and populations. We are going to be the ones that are going to have to ask for this. People with disability, people of color, because it's been arduous on everyone, but we know that marginalized folks have more complex barriers.
Right.
And so that is not at all taken into consideration. And I'm not just speaking about my workplace, or I'm just speaking about work careers and transitioning back into careers in general. And so really looking at how can we create those safe spaces or safer spaces, I guess, for people to feel confident in, hey, maybe coming back or not having to, that people understand that it's been a rough go. And we need a little bit of time to breathe. And that doesn't take away from how important we think that our jobs are, how passionate we are about them. Yeah. So from that perspective, the mental health perspective, I think it's something to be considered. We know it can work. So, and not to say that it's wrong to want to have an in-person right. work culture. I mean, yeah. In-person work cultures are great. That's what you want to cultivate. Fine. But you have to really think about supporting the folks that aren't ready for that. And from what I understand, you know, we don't really know. I mean, it could just be a handful of people. Why not accommodate?
Right.
That's just my thoughts.
I say this in another episode, but I think it's similar here. I have a really hard time keeping fish alive. And I've always wanted to try. But through that, you learn that you can't put a goldfish in a bowl of water and expect it to thrive just instantly. And I think it's the same thing with racialized people, visible minorities of any kind. And I'm going to say both racial minorities, religious minorities, sexual minorities, all minorities. You can't just put them into a room or a workplace or a university or a school or a hospital, really anywhere, and expect it to work out well. Uh-huh. There needs to be support and there needs to be understanding for what it's like to be the outsider all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I think that we need to do, like, in all of those different scenarios, I think we need to be more mindful and to do better. I think for me, the passion and the challenge are the same thing. I want to make change happen. I want to be in those systems because I want to make a difference at a level where change can actually happen. But sometimes I feel like my voice is not important and it's not heard, and it is the minority voice in the room anyway. But when you're talking about this sort of thing, it's not a priority in the big scheme of things for a lot of people. And that's how I feel. But I think that, like I said before, I think this is something that I voluntarily took on, and I feel committed to it. And I can't believe I'm even saying that out loud right now.
No, that's completely understandable. Yesterday, today, both days, I was just done. It's like, nope, racism doesn't matter to me anymore. I give up. There you go, world. You've
won. There you go, world. You win.
You win.
Yeah. No,
I totally understand it. And it's just, it shifts with the energy and with how much motivation you have to have that extra stress. But you know what? I wanted to just go back and touch on something. You mentioned the fact that racialized students and racialized people in general are the ones that need to be an advocate for themselves and try and get what they need. And like, even just reading that, the thesis that you wrote, I think oftentimes, like, we're the ones lowballing ourselves and handing us the short end of the stick without that advocacy, without, like, you know, pushing forward and trying to get what we deserve in total, whether that's an accommodation for mental health or a day off for a religious holiday or a cultural holiday or something like that, and you don't push hard enough. And I think we can lowball ourselves. So it made me wonder, like, how do you get out of that loop of accepting the standard, you know, accepting the bare minimum?
I think I can only speak for myself. I think that I assess risk in terms of, if I see something, how is this going to impact my ability to provide basic needs to my kids, my family? If I see something and it impacts my workplace life or my, you know, I really am always mindful of how far I can push. But on the flip side of that, sometimes I push harder than maybe I would have in the past because I don't know what else I could lose. You know, that would be worse than, you know, what I would face if I said something. So when it comes to that, I think it's an experiential thing. And I'm more willing to take risks now to push than I was early on in my life, because now at this stage in my life, you know, I think that my experiences have been pretty intense and I've gone through a lot and I've lost a lot. And so I feel like, what have I got to lose by standing up for the thing that brought me down in the first place?
If you had a recommendation for a student or just a person in general who feels like they're in a position where they have to choose between accessing services that they deserve access and that is in their position, or just somebody in a position where they're experiencing microaggressions, for example, or any kind of discrimination, what would your advice be?
I think that my advice would be to go easy on yourself, because acts of resistance looks different for everyone. And sometimes not saying something is stronger than saying something. And sometimes what appears to be you giving up is actually not. It's making a choice to protect yourself or protect people that you love. And so we navigate the systems in ways that empower us, and to not lose sight of that when you feel like you should have done something different or said something else, or, you know, if you feel like it isn't a good time or you feel like you might get hurt or you're trying to protect something that is important to you, it's okay to not say anything. And it is also not your responsibility to hold people accountable for racism that is directed at you. This is where we need allies in the room to say that wasn't okay, because it's hard to be on the receiving end and hold people accountable at the same time. If that happens, I know one of my best friends is a person of color, and something happened one time when we were in Vancouver, and a person was really speaking down to her, and it was obvious that he was just being very rude, maybe racist. And she felt like she should have said more, but she was worried that if she'd said something that it would impact a family member if she said something. So it was like somebody who was providing service in the apartment where her sister lived, and her sister, she didn't want her sister to have like a consequence because she stood up for herself. And so this is what we do, the battles that we choose, and the guilt that you feel afterwards for not standing up for yourself when you feel like you should have. But understanding that those moments are also, can also be acts of resistance. That's my advice.
No, that is great advice. I can empathize and understand and really think, even just think of ways that I could apply that into my life. Because I think even myself, I have a tendency to just go, oh, never mind. Let's just let this one slip by. Yeah. But now I have my final question, which is terribly hard.
Uh-oh.
Yes. The question is, what's your favorite kind of coffee?
I think that I like Americanos the best. I've tried a lot of different kinds of coffee, and I feel like Americano is just a really, it's a good one because you know it's not going to be too bitter, too burnt. It's smooth enough. Like you can just have cream in it. It's like, I just feel like that is as a basic, an Americano would be my favorite. And I really would like to call it a Canadiano instead.
I wonder what the name came from. I do too love Americanos.
And what's your favorite coffee?
See, I can't choose one. I drink a lot of coffee, but I'm not the biggest fan of just like straight drip coffee unless it's a good quality drip coffee.
I guess that.
I like to get like really nice quality coffee beans because I know it changes the flavor. But that's just me.
And we have a Bodum at home where we grind
the coffee
beans and then, yeah, do it like that. Do the coffee press thing. Yeah.
Oh, totally. Me too. It has to be good coffee. No, I'm not choosy, but it just, I would prefer espresso or like espresso based, like Americanos and espressos over just drip coffee, because I think it's there. I have more quality guarantee on that. Anyways, it's been such a pleasure having you here today, Jen. And I really appreciate learning from you and listening to you every time we speak. And just thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an important conversation, and I really appreciate you inviting me to talk about it.
Thank you so much. Thanks. You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website i-on-edi.truebox.ca.